Hi, Nancy.
Welcome to episode 76 of the Front Porch Book Club.
The Front Porch Book Club is a podcast that meets twice a month.
We like to dig deep into the relationship between characters and the worlds they live in.
Grab your book and iced tea and join us on the front porch.
So, Lenny, how was the eclipse?
Fantastic! I'm still in the Corona glow.
Are you?
2 days later. I am.
I love this.
That it was sort of a spiritual event, kind of like it was when we went out to Nebraska. There's something about it. It's a very collective experience with other people. Again, people howling and having all sorts of reactions to it that you experience along with them. My son said something like, oh, I knew this was going to be hard to beat our Nebraska experience. So I was so hoping it would be a positive one. It was absolutely phenomenal. We were on Lake Erie, so very different than being out in the prairie of Nebraska. But we were on the beach, so you still could see that 360 sunset, which is just amazing.
Yes.
We were able to see, because the beach is up a little higher than the water, Seth said, look, the shadow is coming. And I don't know if we saw that in Nebraska.
I do remember seeing it a little bit, but across the water, I think that would be a longer viewpoint.
I think he said we had an extra minute or two than what we had in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. You eat up all of that time during totality, looking around and sharing your experiences. We saw the prominence, which we didn't see in Nebraska. It was just phenomenal. I have to tell you that the people that sat behind us in the grass when we weren't at the beach, we had our chairs set up in tarps and all sorts of stuff. I talked to the lady behind us. She was in Nebraska at the town next to Grand Island.
What?
Yes. They were just one town over. And here I am sitting next to them 7 years later in Ohio.
Are they Nebraskans?
They're from Pittsburgh area.
Okay. So they traveled to Nebraska in 2017, were near us. Then they traveled to Western Ohio along the shores of Lake Erie.
In the East Coast, the weather was very temperamental.
Yeah.
So it was kind of those things where it was a wait and see. Do we head up to New York? Do we head to Ohio? Are we going to go south to Virginia? So the people that were in this area that really wanted to do the zone, and Canada was an option.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a wait and see what the weather was like. Honestly, we got to the border of Pennsylvania and Ohio and even stopped and said, check the weather again. Are we sure we're not going to go north? Are we sure we're going to keep going west? Mm-hmm. Where's the best chance of the clearest sky we can see?
So I believe you may have been one of the most well-equipped viewers of the eclipse, accompanied by three astrophysicists.
Well, yes, I was. At the end of the day, I needed them because I forgot when totality hits, you're allowed to take your glasses off. Uh-huh. So I was like, take your glasses off. He said it loud. So everybody else was like, oh, yeah, we're allowed to do that now. So he kind of helped us through it. He gave us the big countdown. You know, these scientists know exactly the second.
Yeah.
So he gave a countdown for everybody on the beach so we could all know when it was going to hit. They told me what the prominence was because I didn't remember seeing red line before. So that was a special treat. But it was funny. For them, it's a different level. There is still that sort of spiritual awe kind of thing. But the one man that was with was like, I was kind of speechless. Like he didn't have a whole lot to say at that moment, because it's just like, what? You know, you're in awe of this.
Yeah.
It is just an awestruck moment. Mm-hmm. And he even said, walking back from the beach, there was something spiritual about that. Mm-hmm. And he isn't a spiritual person at all. But it was so, so fun, and it was so meaningful. And you know, here's the thing. My son started to cry, and then he started to get me because he said, "Mom, we did it. 7 years ago, we said," he was a senior in high school. We said, "This was the coolest thing ever. 7 years from now, I don't know where your life is, where you'll be. I don't know. We don't know anything. But we're making a pact right here and now. This was the coolest thing we've done in a long time. We're going to do the next eclipse." And we made that pact. And sure enough, we did it. And we found totality and we found a clear sky. We came together again and experienced something outside of ourselves that is so magnificent and wonderful. But with all of that said, the lady that lived in Pittsburgh that joined us in Nebraska and now here, she was crying too. And they weren't the only two. It is an awestruck experience. Oh, it was fantastic. Thanks. Well, you had a partial, right?
Yeah.
A 85%.
85%.
That's worth putting your glasses on and looking outside.
Yeah, definitely worth watching and experiencing. And of course, we experienced our apex of our eclipse here earlier than you did because we were texting back and forth and I was like 16 minutes to go and you're like, oh no, we've got a lot of time before it'll reach here. But it was definitely worth seeing. It was a very different experience than the totality we had in 2017. It was not as dramatic. And I was thinking back in the day, before we understood what was going on with the sun and the moon and the earth, I think people could have been out here on the prairie and have experienced even an 85% eclipse without maybe even necessarily knowing it. Because if you glance up at the sun, you don't see anything different. The air feels a little different. It suddenly got a little colder. It was a cloudless, absolutely cloudless blue sky here, but it felt like it was dim. The birds stopped singing. You could feel something was a little off, but you had to be pretty tuned in. I mean, if you're having a hard work day hunting buffalo, I don't know that you would have really noticed it. Interesting, but a very different experience than totality, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the other thing is I was so happy to have a chance to see your son over Easter.
Oh, thank you for hosting him.
We played with the VR headset and had an excellent time.
Oh, well, he talked about Buc-ee's.
Oh.
Then you went to Buc-ee's with him.
Yes.
He wanted to go to Buc-ee's. No one else wanted to go, and you went with him.
It had not been open very long. It was hard to find parking, and it was a vast parking lot.
Yeah. Thank you for hosting. He had a great time. He loved being with you and your family. And
so happy to do it. Well, so exciting. But today we can also talk about our interview with Dr. Jennifer Cumming. We talk with her about Taylor Jenkins Reid's best-selling book, Carrie Soto is Back. Jennifer was so fun to visit with. She's a researcher and a professor in sport and exercise psychology at the University of Birmingham in the United Kingdom. She's an expert in mental skills training for athletes, exercisers, dancers, as well as young people experiencing homelessness or who are at risk. She's published numerous scholarly articles about the application of sport and exercise psychology to these populations.
Very interesting background she has. And then she took all of that and we talked about Carrie Soto is Back. And it is a fictional story of the world's greatest tennis player, Carrie Soto, who decides to come out of retirement to defend her Grand Slam record, being challenged by upstart Nikki Chan. Because this book gives us a look at the mental and physical state of professional athletes, we wanted to hear from an expert in this area. And Jennifer certainly is, and gave us some good background. and information.
She did. And I think even if you're not a professional athlete or even a recreational athlete like Linda and I are, I think you'll be really interested in hearing her perspective on how these mental skills can be applied by people in any aspect of their life.
Right. Well, let's get to it, Nance.
All right. Welcome, Jennifer, to our front porch.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're so excited to have you today to discuss Carrie Soto is back because we want to learn more about the sorts of mental skills training professional athletes undergo. But first, we want to learn how you got interested in researching the psychology of sports.
That's an excellent question. And it kind of goes back to my childhood, actually, because I was a competitive figure skater back in the day. My home country of Canada, I now live and work in the United Kingdom. As a competitive figure skater, I was often confronted with stressful situations and had to learn how to manage my nerves and how to deal with all kinds of things. And sports psychology was something that was introduced to me fairly early on. It was quite a new concept at the time. This is sort of like in the 80s. But I had a chance to work with a sports psychologist when I was in my early teens. And that kind of cemented the idea that sports psychology could be a really fantastic help to all kinds of athletes. And I had it in my head from an early age that that's what I wanted to do. And so then went on to university, and now I'm a professor in sport and exercise psychology at the University of Birmingham.
That's amazing. When did you start your competitive ice skating? How young were you, and how long did you continue with that?
So I was 9, I think, when I started my first competition, and continued to sort of train and compete until my late teens, when I turned professional and became a professional figure skating coach, and coached for almost 10 years before I came over to the UK to work in academia.
It seems like Canada is exactly the country to be in for competitive ice skating.
We have so many local ice rinks. So growing up, you just had to go around the corner to put on a pair of ice skates and skate outdoors. And there was an indoor rink all over the place. So yeah, you really have lots of opportunities to skate. And of course, Canada's got a long history of producing fantastic competitors. And so back in the day, I was inspired by, you know, Brian Orser, Brian Botano from the United States, all kinds of fantastic skaters. And even now, still love to watch the sport.
I love ice skating. It's one of my favorite Olympic sports. And I've been to like Cascades on Ice or whatever it's called. All those kind of shows. I'm one of the people in the bleachers appreciating that.
Love that. That was me too.
So now you're a researcher. You've done quite a bit of research on mental skills training. And this is also known as psychological skills training.
Just like any physical skill, athletes need to develop the mental side of their sport. So mental skills can be anything from learning how to set effective goals, learning how to talk positively to yourself, developing the kinds of routines that make you feel confident and comfortable and ready to compete. So there's lots of different mental skills. And athletes develop highly, highly kind of well-developed mental skills that enable them to compete in a consistent and confident way. And from there, we also know mental skills training is something that anybody can benefit from. So just like athletes, everybody, whether you're someone who is in the medical profession, we know in the police and armed forces, all of these different areas make use of mental skills training. So actually, it's a very kind of widely used approach. It's just sort of best known with this association with athletes.
So mental skills training allows you to regulate your thoughts and feelings and actions. What are the foundational mental skills that you need in mental skills training?
Sure. So I guess the most four commonly known ones would be imagery. So how you mentally rehearse in your mind's eye, the feelings, etc. Self-talk, how you talk to yourself in a positive, encouraging way. how you relax yourself. So relaxation would be another one. And then the fourth one would be routines. And that's often pulling those things together in a way that prepares you for that performance. So it could be just before you take a shot in golf. It could be sort of between the action, like in tennis. It could be even post-performance routines. So how you enable yourself to recover from a performance.
Those kinds of things, why are they so powerful?
They serve different purposes. All of them can directly improve performance, but they can also do that indirectly through managing our thoughts, our feelings, as well as our behaviors. So often it's about helping an athlete to self-regulate in a way that enables them to be optimally focused. So being able to stay in the present moment, focused on what they're doing while they're doing it. It also helps them to develop an optimal kind of activation level. Sometimes it's called being in a flow state where things happen and you're not too psyched up, you're not too relaxed, but you just hit the right zone for you and your performance. Mm-hmm. So those are just two examples of the types of things that mental skills will enable an athlete to be able to do.
This seems to incorporate a couple of areas like cognitive behavior therapy, stress management. Kind of seems like it's pulling threads from other areas.
It does. And it actually does have its roots in cognitive behavioral therapy. But sports psychology has kind of grown up in its own way. And it's not rooted to any kind of specific therapeutic approach. It also can be very strength-based. So you don't necessarily have to have a problem to benefit from mental skills training, because it's really about maximizing your potential, trying to harness your talent, trying to, and, you know, often they talk about all the 1% in sport that you're trying to uncover and really hone and improve. So yes, it can be used to kind of target specific weaknesses that an athlete has, but it can be just about getting better and performing your best all the time.
Our listeners know Linnea and I are both working hard to become better at sports that we both picked up just a couple years ago.
And we don't have that in our background. Right. So we didn't start ice skating.
No. It's fair to say we were not athletes growing up. Right.
No.
So Linnea plays pickleball and I play tennis. So asking for a friend, what mental skills training techniques help recreational athletes improve their game and enjoyment of the sport?
So the good news is that the same mental skills that elite athletes use can be used at all levels of sport. And as someone who's worked in sports psychology for a long time, I can tell you that I have to work with individuals who are at the highest levels, but also those who just do it for fun and recreationally. So you can benefit from all these mental kind of techniques that we've just been talking about. I guess the trick is to find the things that already start to work for you and to develop those. So for example, some people find it very easy to generate images of themselves performing in sport. And imagery can be a powerful technique because you can use it to help with motivation, with confidence, with focus. It can also help you to develop the technique, build good habits, and so on and so forth. Actually, the outcomes are kind of endless with imagery. So that's a really good one to use when you're learning a new sport like pickleball or tennis.
And I think you wrote an article on this, that athlete imagery ability, it's a predictor of confidence and anxiety intensity and direction. And that was in the International Journal of Sport and Exercise Psychology. So it also helps reduce anxiety. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. And that depends on how you use it. So let's say you are going into a match and you're feeling a bit nervous about it.
That's me. Always.
That's you.
Always.
So one of the things through imagery is that we can have this opportunity to experience ahead of time what this match is going to be like and all the things that are normally there that kind of signal that this match is going to be happening, is going to be important, and kind of brings around those kind of familiar feelings that you go, aha, that makes me think of nerves. So the butterflies, the muscle tension, you know, whatever it is, each person's a bit different on this. Through imagery, we can experience that sort of scenario and we can bring about all those feelings, But we have the power through our imagination to be successful in that situation and cope with it. And so we start to teach our body and our mind that this situation isn't the threat that we often think it is. Actually, we can start to reframe it. We can change the meaning of it to being more of a challenge. So something that we're confident and ready to do, we're prepared, we're trained for it. And we can play out all the different scenarios that typically might make us nervous, but then use it to then try to master that situation and build that confidence. So it's something that I call coping imagery, and something that can be very, very powerful for athletes to use to help manage their nerves and be confident in the situation that they're about to face.
And so this is not about pretending not to be nervous. It's acknowledging the nerves, but then just using this imagery to show yourself that you can overcome the nerves, or it doesn't have to affect your performance. Is that it?
Yeah. So it comes from the area of psychology that helps people overcome fears like spiders, snakes, public speaking. So this idea that we can almost systematically desensitize you to a fear. This is based on work by Peter Lang. He used imagery with people to overcome these very like well-rooted fears by helping them to see it, feel the situation in the way that would be very realistic. All those same kind of feelings and thoughts that would be happening, but then trying to change the meaning of it. And so in sport, we recognize like, we get this all the time. So actually we can make use of it. So a lot of the research I've done over the years has been to try to really develop these kind of imagery techniques. We know it's very powerful to image things in a way that's we call in a mastery way. So everything happening perfectly and you feel really confident by that and really positive by that. But in the real world, things happen and you need to be able to deal with these different situations. And so actually training athletes to cope with them is a very powerful mental technique.
You can certainly see that in the book, Carrie Soto. I think she could have benefited from some of this, Jennifer. You get an appreciation inside look at what competitive sports is. She does a really good job at being focused on her goal, but boy, she has some blind sides too. So in thinking of the psychology behind this, where do you see the deficits, first of all, and then how would you approach it? She definitely has some deficits.
She absolutely does. And I think the author, Taylor Jenkins Reid, does a fantastic job of giving that kind of insight of what it's like to kind of live, breathe every day in and out a sport and the dedication that it needs to kind of get to the top, stay at the top. And in this case with Carrie Soto, return to the top when you are considered to be too old for the sport. And what's surprising, but maybe not given the era that the book takes place in, is that the first time she encounters this idea of mental preparation comes from a conversation with another character, Bo Huntley. I think he kind of sort of suggests to her, oh, have you heard of this book? I think you need it. And she kind of goes, no, I mean, I could have written the book. And by this point in the story, you think, no, you really couldn't have written the book.
No, you couldn't.
And I love the fact that the character of Bo kind of says, well, just by saying that, you're kind of, yeah, just reinforcing my whole point that you probably do need it. And then he goes on to kind of explain to her this idea of self one, self two that isn't in the book. There's variations of that kind of theme all over psychology. And I think what's really interesting about this character of Carrie Soto is that she has such a clear athletic identity. She's described as from the time she's in a high chair, before she can even crawl, before she can even walk, she's watching tennis. She's absorbing the messages that she's going to one day be the greatest tennis player in the world. She's never had a chance to explore different things. So she's got what we call a foreclosed identity. And that kind of speaks to so many of the psychological issues that she has over the course of her adulthood. So by the age, I think she's 37 in the time the book takes place. she's not yet actually gone through probably a normal adolescent development. She's still figuring herself out. She hasn't quite worked out who she is, what she wants to do, and where she's going in life. So as a sports psychologist, one of the things I probably would spend some time with her on is trying to work out who Carrie really is. Like, who is she as a person? Let's try to separate you from the tennis player, and let's work out what are the things you're interested in doing. Where else can you see yourself going in life? Because one of the things we do know about athlete career transitions, and particularly the retirement one, it can have such a negative impact on an athlete. It can cause all kinds of problems, including mental illness, if they haven't prepared for it. And when a career ends abruptly, and although Carrie's first sort of stage of professional career doesn't end necessarily abruptly, it doesn't end by choice, does it? Mm-hmm. It's injury that kind of drives it. Her performance is no longer at the level she wants it to be. And her coach kind of puts her in a position saying, well, I'm not going to coach you anymore. So of course she comes to a point where she ends the sport, but she hasn't really finished with the sport. And that kind of career transition is often quite problematic. So it's not surprising that she finds a reason to come back. And the book hints at it, doesn't it? It sort of says it almost didn't matter if this athlete that she's competing against has got her record. She's just looking for a reason to come back. She already always knew she was going to do that. So that's, I guess, one of the things I would really want to tackle as a sports psychologist is around these ideas around identity and what else drives and motivates her so that she can become a more well-rounded person.
Yeah, she's definitely not well-rounded. And I appreciate everything that you said there, because I think she is really blind of who she is or who she is if she might fail. That's kind of like the things outside of yourself. This drive that you see with people who are professional athletes, do you think it's steeped in that? That it's, I just have to win. It's who I am. Because Carrie is really never happy. Some of the other characters are happy with a third, or I mean, maybe not happy, but they're willing to play the game knowing they may never be the gold medal winner. They're just playing with a group of people and touring around with them.
Well, I think if we think about Carrie's personality, the way the author describes her, the hints that are dropped along the way, I would say that she's probably got strong perfectionistic dispositions where her best is never going to be good enough. So across all the records that she breaks, the fact that she is the top female athlete and has held on to this for longer than anybody else has in the history of female tennis before this point in terms of the story, that's still not good enough. She has to keep going. And the threat of this being removed, again, not good enough. So although her father throughout the second phase of her career is really encouraging her to find the enjoyment, the fun of it, she just doesn't get what that is. Because that's not something she ever really associated with her sport. What's driven her was this, you know, need to be absolutely perfect, this drive for excellence, but that making mistakes, not performing to the standard that she thinks she's supposed to be at, is devastating for her. And that kind of rings true for athletes who have very strong perfectionistic tendencies, where this is a very double-edged sword. It can be the thing that brings about greatness, but it's also the thing that brings such distress, especially when things don't go well. And when Carrie starts to become injured, performance doesn't go as it should, you could just imagine the kind of distress this would have caused her.
So what kind of techniques do you use with athletes to balance this desire to win, maybe perfectionistic tendencies, to enjoyment of a sport?
Yeah, and it often starts with the reasons why they're doing it in the first place. And one of the things I like to do with athletes is ask them, you know, what are the reasons why you do your sport? If you think back to when you started to now, how have those reasons changed? We know from research that even the best athletes still list having fun as one of their top three reasons for why they do their sport. It's kind of a key motivational quality that helps sustain you over the long term, but in a healthy way. And so if you're missing that, then the reasons why you're doing your sport can be often very controlling. So for Carrie, you get the hint that her motivations for doing her sport aren't out of interest, excitement, joy, for the pleasure of its own sake. It is very much because she feels like she has to, and if she doesn't, there's going to be some real like damage to her reputation. Like she almost feels like she's fighting the fight for women's tennis, and that she needs to kind of keep out there in front, because the threat of losing that would just mean her whole identity would be wiped out. And so her self-worth is like contingent on this, which is really unhealthy.
It's unhealthy for her, because I want to talk about Javier, her father. Mm. He's her coach, even from a very early age. But he says, Carrie, that person might be better than you. She can't hear that. And your analysis, I think, of her personality draws into that. No, this is who I am, and I am the best. So he feeds into that, I think, somewhat as her coach, to put that bar pretty high for her. So let's talk about coaching. Now, I didn't realize that you had been a coach. What did you think of Javier's coaching and him setting the bar kind of high with her? Where do you think he went well as her coach? Where do you think he went off the rails a bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating character, Javier the Jaguar, as he's nicknamed in the book, which is fantastic. I love that little detail. He's described as someone who loves the beautiful game of tennis. Like, technique to him is so important. And one of the things that I think is really positive about his coaching is that he's very aware of how poor technique could damage the athlete's body and shorten their careers. And so he's very careful to ensure that Carrie has the best technique possible, which is one of her real strengths in the sport. But probably where he goes a bit wrong is that when we start introducing children to a sport, it's really important to give them a real strong basis of fun and play, and try to prevent getting too quickly into the serious, deliberate practice that Carrie's exposed to from, like, I think almost from like 2 or 3 years of age. Yeah. So she never had a chance to build this base of intrinsic motivation, this love, this fun of the sport, before it became so serious. So she's already 10 years into the sport by the age of 11. I mean, that's really would be unusual. And she's already trying to compete with world-class tennis players at the age of 11. Maybe he puts her into this situation where she has this match against, I think, the 14-year-old. Is it Mary Beth, the character?
Yes.
And he sets her up purposely almost for failure to see how she responds. Of course, she's not going to respond well to this, because he demands such perfection from her. So one of the things that can be detrimental to the coach is when you have such a strong orientation to demanding perfection. And I'm not talking about like asking your athlete to be excellent. You're demanding perfection where their best is never good enough and you don't think their best is ever good enough. That is quite problematic. You're creating an environment for these perfection tendencies to really, really grow. Although he later starts to really emphasize the fun and enjoyment of it, it's too little too late.
Too late. Yeah. Well, now that's very interesting, because I hear athletes sometimes say, well, I'm here just to gain experience. They understand their role and they know that they're not going to win the gold medal or whatever. They have people in their coaching and their training that are not saying you have to be perfect at this level, but having other reasons for them, they can get the feel of it, understand what it is to travel, whatever other things that are out there in the sport. Javier basically gets fired. Where do you think that disconnect is for Carrie and him?
Yeah, talking about the first part of her career, and she leaves him for another coach. After he kind of starts to say to her, I think you've done everything you can do. Is it time to move on? And she starts to think he's doubting her. And as soon as he has any doubt in her, she cuts him off and goes to this other coach. There's even a point where they don't speak for quite a long time. And it's really interesting because here you have this parent coach in a dual role and then trying to learn how to navigate this with a fairly young, she's still quite young. She's still not a fully formed adult. She's not, hasn't probably even hit her mid-20s yet when her brain has fully developed. And yet she's having to make some really big decisions, and she doesn't do it in the best possible way because she kind of goes behind his back and kind of agrees with the coach and just cuts him off. In some ways, he probably could have seen that coming, but he probably has blinders on as well, because from the moment she's born, he's developing her to be this tennis great and he's constantly training her. So when she's not practicing on the court, he's questioning her. He's asking her questions to make sure she understands all the rules of tennis and the fundamentals of it. It's nonstop. The only kind of break she gets is going to school, and school doesn't seem to be a great source of enjoyment and esteem for her. She doesn't have many friends. She doesn't seem to do that well. And so really it all comes from tennis. So if it's all based on this and the one person who's been your supporter all the way along all of a sudden starts to doubt you, it didn't come to me as a surprise that she then leaves him.
The other two athletes that we get to know the best in Carrie Soto Is Back is Nikki Chan. She's the young phenom who ties Carrie's Grand Slam record and puts in motion Carrie's return to the sport. And then Carrie's romantic interest, Beau. And they each have very different relationships to tennis. What did you think about their ability to balance the rigors of professional sports and having a balance and a life and being able to not be pursuing this really impossible goal of being the best athlete of all time? I thought the author maybe gave us those two characters as a demonstration of more healthy relationships that professional athletes might have with their sports.
I would definitely argue that they're healthier, but probably not healthy. Beau Huntley, I think he's a fantastic character in terms of showing the contrast between someone who took this break and coming back to someone who's trying to sustain it and having to deal with the fact that his abilities are getting slowly and slowly worse over time and the inevitable end is coming and he's kind of still holding on to that. And he just wants to have like one great more tournament before he feels like he can put it all behind him. But he's getting injured left, right and center. He's leading this kind of nomadic experience that we know that professional tennis players have, where you're just kind of moving around all over the place and you don't feel very rooted anywhere. He doesn't have a really great support system around him. He doesn't have a coach. He doesn't seem to have much in his life outside of tennis. So you don't get a really good sense of his connection. So actually kind of reconnecting with Carrie and becoming her kind of partner to train with on her return to tennis has probably come at a really good time with him. And I love the relationship that develops between him and Javier, because you kind of get to see his coaching through a different lens and how he connects with a different athlete. And I thought that was really delightful.
Mm-hmm. And what were your thoughts on Nikki Chan?
I love Nikki Chan as a character, because I think she was able to connect with Carrie in a way that nobody else could, because finally Carrie has found a peer. She's found someone that she grudgingly learns to respect. And Nikki kind of forces her to become friendly. And Carrie doesn't have the skills to make friends. She doesn't know how to do this. She's never done it. She's been trained from an early age that your opponents are your enemies. You do not make friends with them. Even though these professional tennis players who lead this nomadic existence, the only people they really see on a regular basis are their opponents. And so the fact that she's cut herself off from everybody else has gained such a bad reputation. Finally, here's someone who kind of breaks through the cracks of this hard steel veneer that she's built up around herself. And I just loved all the conversations that they had together. And just bit by bit, you could see Carrie warming up. And you saw the glimpses of this person who she could be. I just love the twist at the end when Carrie becomes her coach. That was absolutely fantastic.
So you said you thought that Nikki and Beau were healthier. What do you see as their deficits in terms of their relationship with the sport?
if we take Bo, at the time the story comes about, neither of them have coaches or entourages, which is really unusual for players at that high level. And so normally, and maybe this is more of a 2024 lens where the book takes place in the 90s, is that they have people around them to support them. So even if they're changing coaches, they still probably have access to athletic trainer on their strength and conditioning. They have access to sports psychologists. They have access to assistants to help them plan all their travel, etc. So although I think Bo shares the same sports agent as Carrie, you don't get a sense there's anybody else really there supporting and cheering and helping him on. In fact, they talk about how his parents don't really take much notice of him as a professional player, mm-hmm. and would have preferred if he'd actually gone something a bit more academic. So he doesn't have that kind of support. You get the sense that they're playing tennis at a very high level, but they still have some areas to improve. So with Nikki, they pick up on the fact that she's got some bad techniques. She just throws herself all over the court, doing the shots that have enabled her to win. But now that she's getting on a little bit, her body is getting a lot of wear and tear, and her career is threatened to be shortened if she doesn't sort of fix these things. And Bo, with his own injuries, he has to work really hard to come back from them. And each time he gets injured, it probably is going to take longer and longer to bounce back with that kind of aging body. And he's quite resistant at first to changing his technique. But because he realizes this is kind of his last shot, I think he starts to go, you know what, maybe I will take this advice. And as he changes the technique and realizes he can be successful, he's open to more change. And so you kind of get the sense that actually he's kind of come over the other side of maybe someone who was quite stubborn and not able to take on coaching to now at this very final stage of his career, he's a little bit more open to it. So I think these characters go on their own sort of journey alongside Carrie, which is really interesting. And I loved just getting more glimpses into this kind of world of the professional tennis circuit.
Yeah. Given the nomadic nature of professional tennis, maybe also other sports like ice skating, where you are going from tournament to tournament, what are the techniques that can help keep athletes healthy mentally?
Yeah, and keep grounded as a kind of well-rounded individuals. And in fact, one of my recent PhD students, Saul Schramm, he did some work on this very question. And one of the things that really seems to help them is to have sources of social support that they can keep connected with, because tennis is somewhat unique in that the schedule is very grueling, mm-hmm. and it goes on for a very long period of time. There's very few times in the year where they can have some downtime, where they can go back home, reconnect with family, friends. And so it can be a very lonely existence, which can have quite a detrimental effect on their mental health. So being able to have that kind of social support is really important. And in fact, in Saul's research, he found that the pandemic provided this opportunity for the players to kind of reset, reflect, reconnect, and actually provided them with a lot of positives of things that they didn't normally get. That's really interesting. And I know the Professional Tennis Association, they're looking at how they can structure the tour in a way that is healthier for the players. And we know that there's a lot of inequalities. The book kind of hints at quite a few of them around gender, the intersection between gender, ethnicity. But one of the big inequalities that comes out in the research we've done is financially. So the top players get the most amount of money. And when you think about the tour, there's so many more players who are trying to get around to all these different tournaments, but have very little that they're taking away from the prize money. And so there's huge inequalities in this, where the best players who are getting the money get to have the entourages because they've got the income to support that. They get to stay in the best hotel rooms, where the players who are further down the rankings are often really struggling financially. And it comes down to, can they get support from their families, etc., not just from a social support, but also from this kind of practical support. So there's a lot going on for these players, way beyond what we see on camera when we're watching these big tournaments.
We're interested in the work that you're doing. The program's called My Strengths Training for Life program. So you're incorporating some of these same strategies with children that are at risk or homeless. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay, so how are you doing that?
This is a program that is now 10 years old. We're actually just celebrating the anniversary this month from the initial pilot program, where work being done in the West Midlands of the UK. So this is kind of in the middle of the country. There's a fantastic organization called St. Basil's. And about a decade ago, they had heard about the work we were doing with a local Premier League football academy. So soccer to our American audience. And they thought, you know what, all that was being kind of talked about, our young people would benefit from. So they contacted me and said, what do you think about taking the sports psychology that you do with athletes, and could we adapt it for our young people? So we're talking about young people experiencing homelessness between the age of 16 and 24. In particular, they were concerned about the group who were not currently in education, they weren't in work, they weren't in training, and they seemed to be the furthest away from it because they were experiencing quite a lot of challenges, complex problems. And so the idea is that if we take mental skills training, it's not about having a problem. It is about providing you with an opportunity to help you move towards where you want to be. So because it comes from that kind of strength-based perspective, it doesn't carry the stigma that's often associated with the types of programs that young people experiencing homelessness get, where they're offered things like anger management or information about drug abuse and how to stop. They don't want to engage with those kind of things. And so those interventions are often not very successful. So one of the things we really wanted to do was to develop something that they said, well, if it's a good enough for an Olympic athlete, it's good enough for me. Because of the type of approach, it can also work with all the different types of young people who are experiencing homelessness. So we had young people who, for example, were pregnant or young moms. We had young people who were justice involved, young people who were coming out of the care system. And it didn't matter. It really didn't matter, because the program was designed to meet them where they were at, help them to develop the mental skills that would enable them to work towards becoming independent. And that's the goal of the program, building self-esteem, building well-being, building resilience. But it's all rooted in the things we do in sport. And so the young people really connected with that. And it's a program that has been now going for 10 years. It's now well embedded within the organization in the West Midlands. And we've developed toolkits to share that with other organizations across the UK, across the world, and enable them to be able to take those kind of mental skills and bring that into the work that they're doing with young people, whether they're at risk or already homeless.
That's fascinating. So what does the program look like? Is it one-on-one counseling? Is it a group setting? How is the program delivered?
It is actually originally developed as a group-based program. So the initial program was 10 group sessions in the supported accommodation that young people were living in. So it's sort of like sheltered accommodation in the United States. And through the 10 sessions, we were helping young people to develop their mental skills for the second part, which was to take them away to an outdoor pursuit center, which was based in the Lake District of the UK, which is a beautiful area of the UK, about 3 to 4 hours from Birmingham. So where we have our young people who, most of them had never really ventured outside of the urban area of Birmingham, to take them to this outdoor beautiful setting was a massive challenge for them. But we wanted them to have an opportunity to develop and use their mental skills in this new setting, where they were climbing mountains, doing high ropes courses, and all these super challenging things, that if they could use their mental skills here, then that job interview a couple weeks later wasn't going to seem like much of a challenge. So we wanted them to have this practice in this real life setting, and then be able to have the confidence that they could take these mental skills with them into all the areas of their life. And so that was the main focus of the program. Over time, we've now developed iterations of it. So it could be delivered one-to-one with young people. And so sometimes it's more appropriate for a young person to have that more one-to-one support to build the confidence before they can get into a group setting. But the idea is to keep upping that challenge so that eventually they feel that they can engage with education, work, training, be able to get their own apartment or flat, as you say here in the UK, and be able to sustain that. So that's the ultimate goal, so that we can really work towards ending youth homelessness.
Well, you picked a tough population. Do you have any outcomes or what's your research showing?
Yeah, so we have some really lovely research showing that young people benefit psychologically from these programs. So they get a boost to their esteem, they get a boost to their resilience, and that this starts to translate into these outcomes. So by adding MST for Life onto the normal support that they receive, there was a 34% increase in young people engaging with education, work, and training. And that translates to huge savings to the public purse here in the UK. So although the population of youth homelessness is relatively small, so let's say in the years when we did extensive evaluation, we had over 1,000 young people in the evaluation. Just moving those young people into education, work, and training over their lifespan would convert to about £26 million of savings to the public purse. So that's a huge, huge difference that we can make just by providing young people with an opportunity to develop their mental skills.
Fantastic.
And then you think of the human capacity and how their lives and their community's lives will be enriched with them fully engaging in the community through work or education as well. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And their children and their children's children. I mean, you're really getting into a cycle, possible cycle situation here. So that's a wonderful outcome there.
What is some of the research that you're working on now that you can tell us about?
Well, we're continuing on to develop mental skills training in different populations. And one of the things that we've learned that after working for now a decade in this area of youth homelessness, we've actually learned quite a lot that we're now translating back into sport. So we're continually all the time working in partnership with community organizations, helping to identify kind of real problems and issues that they're facing and how sports psychology can help. And so one of the areas that we're doing quite a lot of work in right now is in the area of dance. One of my students, for example, is looking at self-harm in dance. Another one is looking at developing mental skills training. So there's all kinds of projects that we currently do and really excited about. But it all kind of comes from this sort of fundamental principle that mental skills can benefit everyone. Our overall project is called the Sprint Project, and it's about taking sports psychology to try to reach in kind of new territories. That's the acronym. But what we found over time that we're actually just doing this lovely cycle of going out into other areas and then bringing the learning back to try and enhance what we know in sport and vice versa.
Fascinating.
What's the best way for people that are interested to engage with you to stay up with what you're working on?
We have a website. It is www.sprintproject.org. And on there, we have regular updates on all the different projects and activities that the group is up to. But we also have a blog so people can sign up for the blog and get our updates if they'd like.
And then you also have a website.
I do. It is www.jennifercumming.com. And that's just where I put the various research projects that I have going on, as well as to provide access to different resources that other researchers might benefit from.
If there is, say, again, asking for a friend, a recreational athlete who is interested in learning more about these areas. Are there particular books or podcasts or anything else you might recommend beyond you've talked about your blog that might be helpful?
Yeah, we actually do have a toolkit and some online resources on our blog. So anybody can go on there and download them. That will enable you to kind of go through and do your own strengths profile and look at goal setting and all kinds of kind of really key mental techniques. But there's some fantastic books available around mental skills. And one of my favorites happened to be written by a professor of mine back at the University of Ottawa, Terry Orlick. He has had a number of books, but they're the real classics in sports psychology. So I think anybody who kind of wants to get into the area would be a good place to start. The Mental Links of Excellence and various other books by Terry Orlick.
Very good. Thank you so much for joining us on the front porch. It was fascinating for me to hear about sports psychology as a discipline, the work you're doing, but so fun then to be able to talk about this in the context of Carrie Soto is Back.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed it as well.
Thank you. Okay, Nancy. Very interesting interview, wasn't it?
I loved it.
Yeah, we talked a lot about imagery, and I am a big fan of imagery. And every time somebody reminds me of imagery, I remind myself I need to use imagery more. And this just isn't for the athletes. This is just for life, for being a better person, being a happier person, reaching your next goals. And so I don't think people can say enough about imagery.
How have you used imagery in the past?
I have used it a little bit to reduce stress, seeing myself successful and as a grounding technique.
So do you imagine yourself in a situation that you think will be stressful?
Yeah.
What does that look like for you?
And surviving it.
Yeah.
And getting through it. Nancy, even when we were in the band, now she talks about the 70s as kind of the upstart of some of this. But in the 70s, we used imagery. We had to walk through our band show. I don't know if you remember that, but we would have to sit back. We would have to remember, okay, we're going to do the show and it's going to be in our head and we're going to walk three steps and then we're going to turn right. And we used imagery even then. Because the more you use imagery and the more you're successful at using it, the greater your chance of success was what she talked about. But it's used also in how she said, overcoming stress. Oh, I didn't get that goal or I didn't make that shot. Okay, let me rehearse it in my mind that I can do it again. Mm-hmm. So as quick as like pickleball is, it might not be imagery. I might actually do the hand motion with it to reset what I did by practicing it or imagery again. Like, okay, I didn't swing that quite right. I need to re-image it in some way.
Mm-hmm. I forget that mindset is extremely powerful and that these techniques are not just someone's good idea. They're research-based, they're evidence-based mm-hmm. techniques that have very positive outcomes.
Now, I would call it narrative therapy, and she didn't really use those words, but kind of reframing, I think, is the word she used in some of the things, using positive self-talk. Do you use those? Because I'm pretty much more aware now of negative things that I say to myself and that I need to change it right away. And so I do use that a lot quite often too.
So how do you use that during a pickleball match?
Oh, Linda, you're such a, I can't believe you did that. The next time I will get it. I will learn from that mistake. I see what I did wrong. I don't have to do that again. Anything that's really quick. But as soon as I catch myself, you stupid or like, you know, the negative things that, oh, doggone, I can't believe you did that. Or you need to lose weight or whatever it is, like to stop right there and say something really quick to replace mm-hmm. it.
I think that would be very helpful for me because my mental self-talk is, oh, there I did it again. Or, oh, they're just better than me. Or I'm just not going to be able to do this. So it does seem like that reframing, that more positive self-talk would be helpful.
Yeah. And again, I think we talked about this before. Because you're playing a quick sport, you have to kind of have those quick go things to say, like, those people might be better than you. So you're not glossing it over saying, oh no, I'm Carrie Soto, I can do it, I am the best tennis player in Lincoln, Nebraska. You might say, they may be better than I am, but I'm going to play to the best of my ability today.
Yeah.
Or the next shot is going to be my next best shot. Or I can turn this around. Like, I do that one a lot. I can, just because I failed this one doesn't mean I can fail the next one. I can reset it and do better the next time. You know, just like really simple phrases that I use to reset myself. But the negative self-talk is very strong with me. It is easier the more you do it, but it's still something I have to do constantly.
That's especially fascinating coming from you as someone who is a professional counselor and knowing that it's something you even have to be very conscious about. It makes me think about something I've been trying to do a little bit more of, and that's setting my intention. And so it feels like it's similar to this. So what is my intention as I go to this meeting, as I go to this match, as I go meet this person for coffee? I was wondering, how does all of this then relate to the overall idea of self-awareness? Is this all interrelated to self-awareness?
I think what you're saying is it's very purpose-driven almost. Mm-hmm. Setting an expectation and a goal for yourself so that you don't get lost along the way. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly
it. Yeah. So that seems a little different. But like we did talk at the interview with her, is that some good coaches are really purposeful and intentional in selling that to their athletes. Your goal in this meet is that you experience what a competition. Your goal in this meet is for you to get your best score. You're not going to get the Olympic score. You're not going to break the Olympic record. Your job this meet, because you're at the top of where you are, or you're not at the top, your goal is this particular goal. And that is your goal. Your goal by the time you get to the Olympics is higher, but your goal right now is at this level. And that purposeful, intentional, I think not getting lost, but knowing, did you achieve what you wanted to do? And if not, why? What can we change? What can we do differently to get to the next goal and to use that as a measurement? Mm-hmm. Is that kind of related to what you're saying, Nance?
Yeah, I think so. That is more related to not getting lost in the moment, to know what my goals are in advance. And even I found that if I don't consciously even think about them during what the meeting, the whatever, that often somehow just making that goal and thinking about it kind of lodges that into my subconsciousness. And afterward, I think, oh, I really did manage to do that.
Yes. And so then what does that do to your confidence?
That does help my confidence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was one of the areas that she said that is it the like the top four things is that confidence. Because I know if I set a goal and I've achieved it, then that lifts up my self-esteem. That makes me feel better. That gives me efficacy that I have control over my own experiences in my life. And that's all positive, good outcomes, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know that I'm very intentional like you. I'm going to use that. I think that's a good thing. So I may just think about intentionality more.
Yeah.
I like it, Nance.
This is such an interesting topic. Just feels like there's so much here that we know about through the research that people like Jen are doing. And yet it also feels like maybe there's so much we still don't understand about how the mind operates.
Right. Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it's all good stuff, Nancy. Next month, we're going to be reading a new book. Would you like to talk about it?
Yes. So since it's Mother's Month, we are reading a book called Stories for My Kids by Eileen Dunavant. And this was a recommendation from one of our listeners who also happens to be a beloved cousin, Eileen's her aunt. She suggested that we might be interested in reading the book. It is Eileen's stories of growing up. And I know you've actually already even read the book.
I have.
Yeah.
You're going to like it. It is sweet and endearing. And she goes back to her own childhood where there's ice boxes and running around on a streetcar by herself at a young age. And just a different time, you know, horses and the old times.
And then we're so excited we are going to be able to interview Eileen. She is 90 years old, and that will be the second episode in May.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to it. She's, you know, she's just of that generation that lived through so much.
Yes.
So much technology change.
It's unbelievable.
Some wars. I mean, just when you put the whole life of hers together, it's just an incredible experience. And so lovely that she made this book and that her descendants now will have that for generations to come of what life was like.
I'm definitely looking forward to it. Well, everyone, thanks for listening. Maybe mention it to someone who also might enjoy listening to our discussion about books and with experts and authors. You might also want to visit our website. It's frontporchbookclub.com.
Our episodes come out twice a month on the first and third Wednesday of every month.
See you next time, Lenny.
See you, Nancy.
You know?